Good morning, this is AM, I'm Simon Santo. A Yazidi activist in northern Iraq says Islamic State fighters from Australia have been involved in sexual slavery in the Middle East. Amina Saeed spoke to Yazidi girls who escaped after being held captive by Islamic State. They were in no doubt an Australian fighter was one of their captors. Amina Saeed's account is backed by Amnesty International. Middle East correspondent Matt Brown reports.
Because the Yazidis are not Muslims, the Islamic State group views them as infidels who can be killed. And many of the Yazidis who fled the advance of Islamic State through northern Iraq in the middle of this year say the extremists kidnapped their women and girls. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, were subjected to forced marriages and sexual slavery. Some have been released after their families paid a ransom. Others escaped. Amina Saeed, a Yazidi activist who's helped free and resettle the victims, says they told her an Australian was involved at a site across the border in Syria. Most of those held by the terrorists are women and children, she says. So far, some 500 have been released. Some of them, who were released from this place, told us that amongst the guards, one was from Australia, an Australian man. There's obviously no independent proof of this man's identity, but the victims say it was well known. The girls told me this man was infamous because he was one of the Islamic State leaders, she says. They stayed 2 months in Syria after they were transferred from Mosul. The ISIS leaders used to visit them and forced the women to become Muslims, so they spoke together for a long time, and that's also how they know their nationalities. In fact, Amnesty International says 4 Yazidi women and girls have identified 2 Lebanese Australians. It says they held the Yazidis in their homes, and one was already living with his Australian wife and their children. Amnesty's recent report cites victims who say the fighters separated out married women from those who were single and then concentrated on the youngest and prettiest amongst them. Even men who are not fighters with Islamic State have been involved. Amnesty's been told that local businessmen in Mosul who had good relations with the militia have taken abducted Yazidi girls and registered marriages at the local Sharia court it established. Those who've escaped this hell now face the hard task of recovering, while much of the time other members of their family remain missing. And the thousands of Yazidis who've disappeared in the last 4 months are just a drop in the ocean amongst Iraq's mass of displaced people. The UN mission there has just released its latest estimate. More than 2 million people have been forced from their homes.
Middle East correspondent Matt Brown. The French government has stepped up security in public places over the Christmas holiday season after 3 separate violent acts raised fears of Islamist extremist attacks. 3 men in 3 days in 3 different locations have attacked pedestrians or police. Authorities say 2 of the 3 attacks were by mentally disturbed individuals heeding the Islamist extremist call. Europe correspondent Mary Guerin reports.
They're repairing the Christmas market stall in Nantes a day after a man ploughed his van into it, injuring 11 people. He then stabbed himself with a knife. It was a chilling attack, not least because it was the 3rd random violent attack in France in 3 days. The day before in Dijon, a similar attack by a man driving into pedestrians. The day before in Tours in central France, a man was shot dead after attacking police with a knife. Only that first attack is suspected to be linked to an extremist Islamist agenda. The following 2 are thought to be copycat reactions by men with a long history of mental illness. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls was quick to play down the notion the 3 were linked as a coordinated terror plot.
Dans une société qui est déjà fragilisée.
He says in an already fragile society, some individuals suffering from psychiatric disorders can react. They can be receptive to propaganda messages or the strength of an image. Witnesses at each of the 3 incidents have claimed the men yelled Allahu Akbar, or God is the greatest, in launching the attacks. But other witnesses and local authorities have disputed that in the latter 2 cases. Nevertheless, fears about radical calls to arms and their effect on the vulnerable and volatile are growing. Raffaello Pantucci, the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London, sees the parallel with Sydney.
Again, we're dealing with individuals that in some cases at least are being reported as having some sort of social issues, We're dealing with individuals, in some cases, that seem to be on the periphery of some sort of investigations. And we're dealing with people that are doing essentially quite low-tech loan attacks against rather random targets, but, you know, again, high-profile places.
So how does a government, how does a society approach this problem? Do they approach it like it's a mental health issue or a terrorist issue or a bit of both?
Well, it really becomes a bit of both. You know, you've got a number of things at play here. On the one hand, you've got this very big brand and this very big idea out there now of Islamist terrorism, in particular Islamist terrorism associated with ISIS. And that is a very sort of big and attractive idea that, you know, draws people to it. And amongst people that draws to it are unfortunately some of these deranged people who have their own sort of social issues. But at the same time, you do get individuals who are less, who do not have mental health problems, but are sort of driven by the same ideology. And yet the expression of the incident that they will try to do is usually similar.
The government has ordered up to 300 extra soldiers to patrol public areas in France for the next couple of weeks, wary of any more unpleasant surprise deliveries this Christmas. This is Mary Guerin for AM.
Christmas is the season when most politicians put down their phones and enjoy some time with their families. But not in New South Wales this year, at least on the Labor side. MPs will spend a good deal of the break deciding on a new leader, after John Robertson quit the job because he'd provided help to the Sydney siege gunman Manharon Monis. John Robertson's resignation puts his party in disarray as it sorts through the candidates to succeed him. Whoever wins that contest will face an even tougher battle in March when the state goes to the polls. That's because the coalition government is at unbackable odds to win another term in power. Michael Edwards reports.
In 2011, after 16 years in power, Labor was demolished in the New South Wales state election. John Robertson was handed the unenviable task of trying to restore the reputation of a party badly tarnished by a combination of ministerial incompetence and corruption scandals. But after 4 years of struggling to rebuild the Labor brand in New South Wales, the former trade union chief was left with no choice but to resign after it emerged he had acted on behalf of the Sydney siege gunman, Manharon Monis, who was a constituent of his in his Western Sydney seat of Blacktown.
It has become clear to me that I have lost the support of some of my senior colleagues.
Manharon Monis held 17 people at gunpoint for 16 hours in the Lindt Cafe in Sydney's Martin Place last week. Monis, along with two of his hostages, died when heavily armed police stormed the cafe. It emerged earlier this week that in 2011, Mr. Robertson had sent a letter asking for Monis to have a supervised visit with his children while an apprehended violence order and family court proceedings were underway against him. He condemned Monis' actions, but stood by his choice to help a constituent at the time.
Being elected as a local MP is a great honour, and it also comes with a duty to represent everyone in the area. However, I accept how this letter may appear given the recent events.
Mr. Robertson has urged his colleagues to rally around whoever is elected in his place ahead of the March state election. Labor's Treasury spokesman, Michael Daly, has put up his hand. The acting leader, Linda Burney, says it's too early to decide, and another possible contender, Luke Foley, will have to switch from the upper house to a lower house seat if he was to win the job. Whoever wins, it's going to be a tough job to unseat the Liberal government, led by Premier Mike Baird. Bruce Hawker is a political consultant and a former senior advisor to the Labor Party.
Whoever it is won't have an extremely high profile. The party itself will have to start rejigging a campaign strategy, its advertisements. All these things are going to be very difficult tactical problems for the party to deal with. None of this is good news for Labor at all.
Another big question going into the election will be electricity privatisation. Mike Baird is pushing to sell off the state's electricity assets, a move opposed by John Robertson. His successor will be under pressure from many senior Labor figures to change this. The New South Wales Labor caucus will meet on January the 5th to elect a new leader.
Michael Edwards. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 19 and a half minutes past seven. As Australians unwrap their presents tomorrow, one of the must-have gifts this year is set to cause some high-flying headaches for the nation's firefighting authorities. Drones, or unmanned aerial vehicles, were once largely used for military purposes. Now, at prices in reach of ordinary Australians, they have the capacity to take amateur photography and video literally to new heights. Already that's causing significant privacy concerns with their ability to sneak pictures from above. And with summer upon us, a push to have them banned in bushfire zones continues to gain momentum. Tim Jeans reports.
In the past, it may have been a Cabbage Patch doll or a Rubik's Cube. But the latest in-present is far more technological and is giving some groups plenty to worry about.
We can expect multitudes of drones in the skies. Probably the most sought-after techno gift that one can expect for this Christmas, and I think there are going to be plenty more recreational drones being operated by those less informed, I suppose, and less educated.
That's Joe Early, the president of the Australian Certified UAV Operators Association, the nation's peak body covering the operation of drones. Of particular concern is the unauthorised use of drones over firegrounds, where they pose a danger to aerial firefighters. Mr. Early says the prospect of a post-Christmas surge in their use makes the need for regulation in such situations even more urgent.
Unfortunately, the technology is so advanced that the skill to fly one of these has been taken away completely, so it's literally take it out the box and put in the battery and send it up. The ability to fly 3,000 feet within 10 minutes of firing it up.
It's that kind of ability that last month saw some firefighting groups say they won't undertake aerial firefighting if there are unauthorised drones in the region. Adding to the concern is the fact that drones are usually powered by lithium polymer batteries, which can explode and cause another fire if they crash. Phil Hurst is the chief executive of the Aerial Agricultural Association of Australia, the group which represents aerial firefighters.
Drones might be a toy to the person operating them, but the million-dollar aeroplane plus that's likely to hit it is not a toy.
Like others, Mr. Hurst is hoping a new-look Civil Aviation Safety Authority will prioritise the issue in 2015.
We really look forward to the day when the Civil Aviation Safety Authority or the Federal Department take a much stronger view of the operation of drones around fire grounds.
Mr. Hurst is part of a forum wanting penalties of up to $50,000 for anyone operating a drone in a fire zone.
I think what you're seeing is a lag between the technology and the law. There are a lot of regulations that could be done a lot quicker than a change to an act, and that's what we're pursuing at the moment. We would like to think that early in the new year this would be an issue that would be on the main agenda for the new Civil Aviation Safety Authority management.
That's Phil Hurst from the Aerial Agricultural Association of Australia, ending that report from Tim Jeans. It's been burned before, but Telstra is going back to try and make money in Asia. Australia's biggest telco has just spent $858 million buying the Singapore and Hong Kong-based PacNet. Telstra's hoping PacNet's underwater telecommunications cables and data centres around the region, especially in China, will help grow its business customer base in Asia. The company's chief financial officer, Andrew Penn, spoke with our business reporter, Michael Yander.
One of our aspirations is to grow our enterprise services business in the region. This is anything from managed security, unified communications, which is video conferencing as a service, advanced telephony services. As large companies expand into the Asian region, they have very many quite sophisticated connectivity needs associated with moving data around their networks.
Is this the start of a concerted push into Asia by Telstra?
Telstra's been operating in Asia for many, many years, and we believe it's a very important region for us. We already have more than 1,400 people working in the region. That's in addition to more than 2,000 that we actually have in our very successful auto home business in China.
Now, Telstra has burned a lot of cash with some of its forays into Asia in the past, particularly Pacific Century Cyberworks in the early 2000s. Why will this investment be different from those previous results?
Firstly, enterprise services, that's at a very nascent stage and is starting to grow very rapidly in Asia. For example, cloud computing, where we've been growing more than 30% per annum in Australia. And of course, the other dynamic is that people that want to use the internet amongst those large and rapidly growing populations of emerging middle classes is going to grow exponentially. And basically, we will be operating probably the largest backbone infrastructure of data transmission right the way throughout the Asia-Pacific region. So we believe that puts us in a strategically very important position as that volume of data grows.
On the domestic front, Telstra seems to have had some good news this month, renegotiating the NBN contract overall and also winning some new contracts on NBN construction. Are you happy with the outcomes of those negotiations?
We're very happy to assist the government in the planning and design of the new network, and we're willing to help where that makes commercial sense.
Is this an even better deal in the end for Telstra shareholders than the original one was?
Oh, well, look, our focus has been to keep Telstra shareholders whole. We went into the discussions on that basis, and I think that was recognised by the government, and I think we've achieved that outcome.
Speaking of Telstra shareholders, Telstra shares are actually around the highest levels since about mid-2001 at $6 or thereabouts, but they're still well down on the $7.40 T2 price that many retail investors paid. How much of a motivation is it for Telstra's management to get the share price back up to and above that T2 level?
Oh, look, I've learned from long experience that what you need to focus on is executing the strategy, which is what we're doing, delivering the financial results, which is what we're doing, and if we can do those two things right and consistently, well, then the share price ultimately will look after itself.
Telstra's Chief Financial Officer, Andrew Penn, speaking with our business reporter, Michael Yander. On Christmas Day 40 years ago, news began filtering through to the rest of Australia that Cyclone Tracy had wiped out much of the city of Darwin. 66 people were killed and hundreds more were injured, and most of the city's buildings were ruined. At commemorative events being held in the city this month, people have been sharing stories of survival and loss and reflecting on how Cyclone Tracy shaped them and the city. Sarah Everingham reports from Darwin.
As Darwin prepared for Christmas in 1974, Cyclone Tracy was forming off the coast.
A cyclone is imminent.
Dr. Michael Brotherton was then a medical student working at Darwin's hospital.
I just thought I was going to have a nice, easy night in the hospital with a lot of wind and rain, and none of us expected what was going to happen next.
As the storm intensified, he moved a group of patients into the corner of a ward where they huddled for several terrifying hours waiting for the cyclone to pass.
The windows did start exploding. Then what scared me was the demountable started to lift. And if we went, we were going to go over the cliff into Fanny Bay.
66 people died in Cyclone Tracy. Dr. Brotherton remembers the injured flooding Darwin's hospital on Christmas Day. He also recalls a mother searching for the body of her baby who was ripped out of her arms by the wind. His memories of the cyclone are still vivid today.
I find that I still get concerned when I hear the wind. That was a scary bit, the sound of the wind.
The official wind recording instrument at Darwin's airport was destroyed in the cyclone when there was a measurement of 217 kilometres an hour.
I could see that all the cars that had been parked outside the ward next to the ward, they stacked them up in a line. They were all rolled. The wind had just picked them up and moved them.
Darwin was a city, but it is no more. The heart and soul of Darwin has been torn out, and all that remains is a scene of utter devastation.
Emergency supplies were flown in, and amid fears of a health crisis, thousands of people were flown out. Within weeks, three quarters of Darwin's pre-cyclone population of 48,000 had left.
The decision to thin out the population of Darwin led to the biggest civilian airlift in Australia's history.
The then Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, likened the destruction to the scene after the Japanese bombing of Darwin three decades earlier.
The Australian government is determined to see that Darwin is rebuilt and restored and the citizens of Darwin return.
But the ABC journalist Mike Hayes summed up the concern that Darwin would never be the same.
I'm just wondering about the new Darwin. It might be safer, it might be newer, but Darwin was a place of people with a unique way of life, and I only hope the new Darwin has that character.
For Dr. Michael Brotherton, the cyclone changed Darwin from an informal frontier town to one more like other Australian cities.
The architecture of the town changed from being nice tropical housing to block houses that were concrete bunkers that had to be air-conditioned.
40 years on, Dr. Brotherton still lives in Darwin, but he will not be attending any of the events commemorating Cyclone Tracy.
I don't want to remember the cyclone.
But he says he'll never be able to forget it.
Sarah Everingham. On the financial markets in New York, the Dow Jones is trading at 18,055 points, up 96. And the dollar is buying 81 US cents and 97.7 Japanese yen. I'm Simon Santo, and that's AM for today.